And here we go. Welcome to the Anarchist Investor Live. I am Matt. I'm coming at you every Monday through Friday at noon Eastern on the Ungovernable channel. We're talking about contrarian investment, the economy, markets, keeping your money safe from Wall Street bankers and everything that comes with it. I'm going to pull down the banner really quickly and we're going to get into it today. I've got my tinfoil hat on, but we're going to mix it up a little bit today. It is the day after Fed Decision Day. And or like I like to call it FUD day. But as we're going to be reacting to that and kind of picking through what was said, I want to look at the markets first, because that's just what we're going to do today. We're going to flip flop it a little bit today. All right. So what do I have up on the hold screen? What I had up on the hold screen was silver. Silver ripped along with the supposedly the spin that's coming off the supposedly dovish Fed comments that came out of Jerome Powell yesterday during the as part of the written statement, and then also in the Q&A afterward in the press conference. Silver ripped along with a lot of other things that are inflation sensitive, as well as like growth names and all kinds of other stuff. The market had a party during and right after his comments yesterday. Again, the reaction right after the Fed decision isn't always indicative of where we head afterward. And as you notice, silver's given everything back. Okay. Let me look at gold. Gold ripped as well. New all-time high above 2200, actually above 2225, give or take. Actually, I got to like zone in on this pretty close. No, it's not 22. Yeah, it's 2225 actually. So gold puts in a new all-time high. It has since pulled back really hard. Oil, let's look at what happened to oil. Oil's actually continued to fall even throughout this entire decision. So this is kind of like bucking that inflationary trend. You see the dollar, and again, it's funny, something came up earlier today. I was watching Maneco 64, and if you don't watch Maneco 64, you should definitely watch his channel. He was talking about how the dollar index is basically BS, because or at least you have to take it with a grain of salt, because the dollar index tracks the dollar, a fiat currency, versus all the other, you know, currency pairs that are out there, and they're all fiat currency pairs. So it's not like the dollar index is tracking the dollar versus, say, gold, or say versus Bitcoin or something else out there that is not a fiat, you know, piece of cloth IOU. But that being said, you can use this within context. And so very interestingly enough, immediately after the Fed response, the dollar falls off, okay, which is basically inflationary, and then it rises right back up again, and we're at or above where we were before the Fed decision. So a lot of these things that happened immediately after the Fed decision have been unwound. Let me pull up the crypto complex. Crypto ripped right here, ripped right off of the leading into and after the Fed decision. If you notice, Bitcoin has gotten right back into that trading range like I talked about yesterday, and we're just sitting in the middle of it now. I guess we're, you know, waiting to see what is next, okay? I think a lot of people are anticipating that this rally is going to continue, especially if the inflationary pressures continue because of a dovish Fed. But that being said, there was some stuff said yesterday that I'm going to dig into a little bit here, and I'm not so certain it's like the inflationary tailwind that everyone thinks it's going to be, but let's just kind of let's just look at that once we get there. So yeah, Bitcoin rallied hard. It's sitting in this, like, you know, again, the 64,900 to, you know, 69,000 trading range. We're going to have to see what happens. It didn't have enough weakness to keep going below the range. It hasn't shown yet enough strength to stay above the range and put in new all-time highs again. So we're just kind of in, the middle of no man's land still, just kind of trading back and forth to see what this next move is going to be. And this can last for a while. I mean, if there's a lot of indecision, it could last for months. It could be a couple of days until some other shoe drops and we figure out which direction we're going. But for now, Bitcoin still is maintaining kind of that like 66, 67 $5,000 like middle of that no man's land range right now. Same thing with Ethereum. Ethereum ripped. It actually hasn't given back as much as Bitcoin. They're both kind of pulling back together. But yeah, Ethereum is still up compared to where it was leading into the Fed decision. And again, a reminder on this one, leading into that Fed decision, like not just the hours beforehand, but like the days and like a couple weeks beforehand, most risk assets were selling off. There was a lot of profit taking happening, a lot of people positioning themselves just in case the Fed didn't give everyone what they wanted. And actually what I posted yesterday on X, I think I'm going to stand by, is that with every passing FOMC decision where a rate cut doesn't happen, okay, the stakes get higher and higher because the expectation is there, and the expectation almost grows more, what's the word I'm looking for? Like almost desperate, right? Like I'm waiting for this thing, but you know, give it to me, give it to me, give it to me. And with each meeting where there isn't a rate cut, things get much more like heightened in terms of like the stakes get much higher. And in fact, there was a story out of the bank or the European Central Bank that they're anticipating they're going to start cutting in June. And so the question becomes whether or not the U.S. Federal Reserve is comfortable with Europe cutting first, because again, a lot of this stuff is relative, especially when it comes to currency, right, and inflation. So a lot's going to be determined. I mean, they do coordinate efforts, and so that could mean that the U.S. Federal Reserve is cutting in June, not necessarily the end of April, beginning of May, but in June. So it's something to keep an eye on, but something to remember is that a lot of these assets pulled back before this meeting. They rallied a little bit, but they haven't. I mean, they got a ways to go. If you look at Bitcoin or Ethereum, you know, Bitcoin and Ethereum have a ways to go to get back to those like kind of heightened levels that we were at when we hit the new all-time high in Bitcoin. And, you know, a couple of weeks or actually a few days before the Federal Open Market Committee decision, we've since sold off and we haven't got back there yet. So we have to see what happens here moving forward. It could be, this could be a turning point, or it could just be, like I said, just some sideways action waiting patiently. but, you know, again, very anxiously for that rate cut. A lot of the other cryptos behaved exactly the same. Solana, rip, pullback, Avalanche, rip, a little bit more of a dramatic pullback. Okay. And some of the micro coins, saw a little bit of a rip and a pullback, or some of them saw some continued profit taking and sell off. So, you know, I'm looking at kind of the Helium complex. Helium had a rip and a pullback, but then the mobile token, you know, same kind of deal, except for the fact they're just kind of continuing weakness from before, and they don't even look as strong as some of the other, you know, larger cap cryptos. So something to keep in mind there. All right, the last thing I'm going to look at is the high yield bonds that I've been talking about a lot the last couple of days and the last couple of live casts. We broke through this resistance line. So this resistance line has been broken through. The only question now becomes, can this sustain itself and get back above the top end of this trading range? Okay, so you have a couple of things at play here. We've broken through. We didn't even really test it all that much either, if you notice. The high yield corporate debt, these junk bonds, popped through, they traded sideways and then popped up again, and now they're trading back down. We didn't really come back and retest the resistance line again after we popped through it. So do we go all the way back down to retest it again, or is there enough follow through in this price action in order to get people to start taking on more and more risk? I don't think the Federal Reserve wants the market taking on more risk. I think the Federal Reserve wants things just to kind of remain status quo as far as it goes. And that really is in line with their comments. But what we're seeing is at least the most immediate reaction has been a lot of risk taking. The only other thing, I mean, like there's a couple of things that fly in the face of this, like oil flies in the face of it. Copper is, you know, back where it was at before the decision. And again, it's kind of clunking around this, you know, spider line type level here, trying to determine which direction it's going to go. So, you know, and even gold and silver ripping and pulling back, this doesn't exactly give you a full sense of just one direction, right? There's a lot of things now trying to figure themselves out here. even if you look at U.S. debt, the U.S. Treasury market, the two-year, the shorter-term stuff dropped in terms of the interest rate, meaning they're anticipating the Fed promised we're going to cut later this year. They didn't say when, but they said they're going to cut at the end of the year, before the end of the year. And the dot plots themselves said that the Federal Reserve is looking to cut at least three times. They're looking for an excuse to cut at least three times before the end of the year. I don't know what that excuse is going to be, but I guess we're going to find out. It could simply be coordinating action with the European Central Bank, which again, there's a ton of cash sitting on the sidelines. This could be the 1970s reinflation all over again. Well, we're going to have to find out, but they are looking to cut. So, you know, the short end of the range, yields are coming down. On the longer end of the range, they came down a little bit, but they haven't been coming down nearly as much. And a lot of that has to do with the dot plots. The dot plots actually kind of showed three cuts before the end of this year or into the end of this year. And then they actually kind of boosted what they think the interest rate is going to stay at over the next 2 years. And so you could see the Fed basically trying to navigate this yield curve inversion by, you know, dropping the short end of the curve and attempting to keep the long end of the curve where it's sitting at right now, meaning longer term, we'll have, you know, 4% 10-year U.S. Treasury rates. And that means borrowing rates based off of that 10-year or 30-year U.S. Treasury rate at 4.5% are going to be 5.5, 6, 7% going forward. And the short end of the curve, they have to get lower because the United States government is going to default eventually on its debt if it has to roll everything over, all this $34-35 trillion in debt. About 15 trillion of it is coming due within the next 12 months. If it all gets rolled over to 4, 4.5, 5%, I mean, the budget just gets blown out of the water. Okay. You're talking austerity, higher taxes, the whole nine yards. The Federal Reserve has to cut on the low end. Like, it's going to happen. The question becomes, what does it look like, you know, 1 year out, 2 years out, 3 years out? And I think we're starting to see that take some picture or some form in terms of the picture. But still have an inversion. We still have damage to the credit markets or what they would consider damage. You know, there's not the same kind of reckless lending that had been happening for the last 10, 12 years. And so that's something that they wanted to get out of the system. But then again, what happens when they cut? Does it just go back to, you know, what it normally was before, with the exception of the fact that maybe they don't get exactly what they think they're going to get when they cut? So more on that as it transpires. All right, I'm going to pull this screen share off and I'm going to pull up what we've been talking about in terms of just the story. So this is the CNBC article. Fed holds rates steady and maintains three cuts coming sometime this year. And they just kind of re-emphasize, I mean, this is basically just a regurgitation of everything that the Federal Reserve had essentially said in the written statement, as well as Powell's Q&A afterward. They did expect higher GDP coming in the coming years. And so that's also something to watch. I think that might be wishful thinking based off of how much, I mean, they're anticipating that all this cash is locked up. Once they do start cutting rates a little bit, it's going to deploy the cash and we're going to get higher GDP. The question is, do we get higher GDP at the same time that we get higher inflation? Right? That's going to be the catch 22 for them. And quite frankly, they're walking a tightrope that has, they're on a tightrope and there's a 40 mile an hour wind blowing, right? Anything right now that goes wrong could potentially derail this, right? Crypto crash. There could be a housing market crash. You could also see the opposite effect where there is a housing market, essentially crack up boom that could also cause a problem. Or like happened during Great Financial Crisis number one, you could see oil go to the moon and that basically just destroys consumer spending and the economy falls apart. So they're in a precarious position right now. Speaking of Great Financial Crisis number one, now it's time for me to put my tinfoil hat on. And I have to be careful here. So y'all got to help me because the algo doesn't like me. I talk some smack when it comes to the powers that be in the Federal Reserve. I need your help. So if you can, subscribe, hit the like, you know, follow, upvote, share it, throw something in the comments that you're looking at or what you're thinking about. and your reaction to the federal the Fed's rate decision yesterday and where you think things are going. And that'll help me with the algo. And I have to be careful today because if I put things a certain way, I'm going to get some of my channels canceled. Let me put it that way. But I'm going to try and navigate this and kind of say things without saying things so that I don't get in too much trouble. All right. I've already had a number of videos taken down because I guess I'm too truthful, and truth nowadays is looked at as, you know, disinformation. But so anyway, if I pull up the Fed funds rate over the last, say, last decade, two decades, okay? And this is straight from Fred from the St. Louis Fed, so this is basically their data, okay? We'll see essentially what the trend of the Fed funds rate has been. Great financial crisis, number one, and I'll call it number one, happens basically tail end of 2007 and then lasts throughout 2008 and 2009. What you notice was the Federal Reserve was increasing interest rates through up into the beginning part the end of 2006, beginning of 2007, and then stuff started to fall apart. So they started cutting interest rates, but they couldn't stop the train wreck from happening. They saw it coming. They just couldn't stop it from happening. They tried to ahead of time, but it was just the momentum in the economic cycles. I mean, I talked about it yesterday. The economic cycles are extremely strong. They're important. If you try and fight them, it causes more damage than if you just kind of, you know, leaned into them and rode them out, right? So the Fed tried to get out ahead of the train wreck, and they couldn't stop the train wreck from happening in 2008, 2009. And as a result of it, not only did they put interest rates all the way down at basically zero, but they also took on tons and tons. They printed a ton of money, and they took on tons and tons of garbage assets onto their balance sheet. A lot of those garbage assets were U.S. Treasuries. And also another large amount of those garbage assets were mortgage-backed securities, which is essentially what was at the center of the debt crisis and the great financial crisis from 08 and 09. And those mortgage-backed securities have been sitting on their balance sheet. They haven't been able to get rid of them. And within the last year and a half, they've been trying to get rid of them because in their minds, that helps them pull cash out of the system and slow down the economy or slow down the inflation in order to kind of right the ship, so to speak. But we'll get to that in a second. Before we get to that point, we also have to look at this fact. From basically early 09 until, let's see, November of 2015, rates were essentially 0%. Okay. And so if you were able to qualify for, you know, lending at the Fed or through various facilities with the Fed, even within the banking world, rates were essentially zero, right? And so any VIG that was charged was based off of zero. And that's essentially what lending rates are. There's that baseline cost to kind of like generate the money into existence. And then whoever's lending that money out, say like you're getting a mortgage, they start at that number and then add some to the top because that's the VIG that they want to make, right? Well, it was essentially costing them zero to lend, and anything that they made was profit, okay? Well, in November of 2015, the Fed goes, all right, stuff's been at zero for long enough. We got to start getting some of our black powder back here, because if we do have another financial crisis, we can't cut. We'll end up like Japan. Right, we'll end up with negative interest rates, and then it might actually have the opposite effect. Right, people might get scared and keep their money in the bank despite the fact that they're actually losing, interest on their deposits. But the money is appreciating. We can't allow that to happen. Our economy runs off of debt and inflation. So, at the end of 2015, they start to raise interest rates, and interest rates go from basically zero to essentially 2.5%. Okay, not like an aggressive fashion, not like we've had the last couple of years, right? It took them basically the better part of, you know, 3-4 years to get up to just 2.5% interest on the rates. And then what happens? They start to have an overnight lending crisis in the banks. The banks were essentially having to pay each other like 10% interest because they were worried just on an overnight loan of money in order to cover the float. banks were having to pay like 10% interest, and it was because there was a fear that the bank might not open its doors the next day. Okay, that there was a more than zero chance that those banks wouldn't even be able to open their doors the next day if they couldn't find enough money to cover the float. And this is something I've said in the past too. Every single bank in the United States is essentially operating in an illiquid state. It's just they're able to play the shell game enough to move the money around fast enough so that they don't, you know, essentially go out of business overnight. And so the next day is just the next day trying to keep the thing afloat. And we just go day to day to day to day like that, right? It's also part of the reason why the decreasing velocity of money is such a bad thing in the United States. And believe it or not, over this period of time where there's 0% interest rates, you would think that money was flying around like crazy. It was not. The velocity of money was dropping rapidly because most of these banks and financial institutions had to start trying to hoard cash. And so any cash that they made in interest payments and fees and things like that, they were actually hoarding a lot of it because they had to eat all of those losses from those bad investments. And it's whatever losses weren't subsidized or covered by the federal government and Congress, okay, and taken on by the Fed on its balance sheet. And so there was still a lot of that toxic crap in the system. They had to build cash, which meant the velocity of cash was dropping. Okay. It also meant that lending between the banks was faltering. And so in 2019, we end up with a situation where the Fed goes, oh crap, we can't even raise interest rates to 2.5% gently without the banking sector failing again. Okay. And so in 2019, in my opinion, was great financial crisis number two. The only thing that changed, okay, and you have to remember this. This is where I have to be careful. The only thing that changed was in 2019, they immediately reversed course. They put in all of these different kind of like backroom facilities to try and fix the problem that they were having. And they bring interest rates all the way back down to zero. They expand their balance sheet again. So any limited amount of decrease in their balance sheet completely reversed itself. Now we're back at 0%. And then what happens? March of 2020. And what happened in March of 2020? We had a global pandemic, okay? And after a decade of Federal Reserve governors and FOMC members discussing the fact that it's almost impossible for them to get above 2% inflation, which is what they were targeting. They were below 2% inflation for the entire time. It was impossible for them to raise rates without causing another global financial crisis. It was impossible for them to get any black powder back in the event that there was a major economic problem. And they were basically handcuffed. The Federal Reserve couldn't do anything. They had no influence over the economy and the financial system. And so just out of nowhere, as if it was like Christmas morning in the middle of March, the United States, along with the rest of the world, decided to shut down, create a supply disruption, which then created, I'll use air quotes, inflation, and gave them enough rope to be able to borrow and print more money than at any other time in human history within about an 18-month time frame. Okay? Are you picking up what I'm throwing down here? Right? Like it's awfully convenient. And again, this is, again, it's tinfoil hat time because there's no real direct parallel between the two, right? There's no direct connection. There's a parallel, like there's a coincidence here, okay? There's no real smoking gun, so I can't draw specific conclusions, nor, you know, if I did draw those conclusions, I probably wouldn't be able to speak to you on certain platforms tomorrow, okay? But what I'm saying is it's awfully convenient that all of a sudden in March of 2020, there's an event that allows them to essentially recapitalize, because you got to remember, throughout, you know, 2009 all the way to 2016, then they raise rates. There wasn't enough cash in parts of the system. And by parts of the system, the ones that they find the most important are the banks, right? The Federal Reserve itself is technically owned and operated by the banks and for the banks. They just so happen to allow Congress to have oversight and the president to be able to nominate a Federal Reserve chair. Okay. The system was reset in 2020. There was a pre-bailout. And this is why I know. This is really important. I have to tell you that this is extremely important. The comment yesterday went without any reporter actually paying attention to it. The comment yesterday that Federal Reserve Chair Powell made was in response to a question about quantitative tightening, selling off assets from their balance sheet, and the rate at which they were going to do it. And they've been doing it at a certain rate so far, you know, for the last year and a half, 2 years. And the question was, are you going to slow that down? Because if they're going to start cutting rates, it's weird if they continue to sell assets off at the same rate, because that's restrictive and cutting rates is, you know, accommodating. And so Chair Powell essentially goes on an unscripted diatribe about how they can't continue to do quantitative tightening too quickly, because what they found out in 2019 was that while the system overall might have enough cash in it, there's these areas of illiquidity that happen. Well, those areas of illiquidity, what he's talking about is the banking sector. The entire freaking banking sector had illiquidity as a result of them just trying to raise rates a little bit and sell some assets off their balance sheet. So what he's telling you is exactly what I've been saying, is that they identified in 2019 that they couldn't sell assets off their balance sheet without tanking the entire financial system again. And so they were stuck. And so it just lends credence to this idea that in 2020, it gave them the, I'll call it the opportunity to pre-bail out the financial system, to inject a ton of cash into these financial institutions, because they were still dealing with the hangover from all of this crap from 2008. And quite frankly, when you look at it, you might not immediately think that it's a bad thing or it's as big of an issue as everyone else, myself included, might make it out to be. The subprime loan sector in the United States was only about $1.7, $1.8 trillion. And I use the word only because, I mean, relatively, the amount of leverage that was used in that sector at the time, in some cases, was 20, 30, 40, 50x. In some cases, it was 100x for some of the smaller operators that are out there. So truthfully, the subprime exposure wasn't just 1.7 or 1.8 trillion. It could have been 34 trillion. It could have been 50 or $100 trillion. Okay, people don't understand the magnitude of this. Now, the entire subprime, you know, sector of the mortgage industry didn't fall apart. I think defaults topped out at about 12%. But now you also have to do the math and think about the fact that all of the junk that the Federal Reserve is sitting on right now, all those mortgage-backed securities, have been maturing over the last 15 years, give or take. Okay? They've had time to fully realize what the extent of those losses were. And those losses, they could be better or they could be much worse. Not to mention the fact that a lot of these banks still have this junk sitting on their balance sheet and they haven't marked it to market, right? Like they haven't taken it from, you know, it being worth a dollar down to whatever it actually is worth. It might be worthless, okay? And so these bankers are essentially have been raising cash ever since January of 2009, and they've been trying to hoard it so that if they do end up having to write the stuff off, that they can. And essentially burn cash in what they're writing off and then have cash on hand so that it kind of makes up for that, right? Now, the overall effect of this is inflation, because you're essentially taking currency that existed and burning it and then replacing it with even more to try and fill the hole, right? But so the take home for me from yesterday's meeting was that I think people are mistaken when they think that the Federal Reserve is just kind of making things up. I actually heard this from, I believe it was mentioned on Eurodollar University yesterday as a reaction to this Fed decision. I think a lot of people think that the Fed is either one, clueless, or two, just completely making things up as they go on the fly. And that's not totally wrong. But I don't think it's made up on the fly. I think all of this has intentionally been put in place. It's all been designed this way. And unfortunately, it also coincided, and this is also something that you have to remember, it has coincided with essentially the single biggest theft in human history. And I'll call it theft. Other people will call it wealth redistribution up the chain, right? Up the income spectrum. I mean, billionaires basically, I think the story I saw yesterday was billionaires increased their net worth by like 80% from the pandemic until now. So at the expense of the prosperity and the quality of life and the future prosperity of the middle class and everyone below the middle class in terms of the income spectrum, they essentially funneled 80% more wealth to the wealthy. And they're doing it so that they can kind of like, you know, hold everything together with, you know, spit and duct tape to try and keep the train on the tracks. And now they've gone through and they've done this extreme experiment about this kind of financial system reset. And we're seeing the results of it. And the results of it are stagnation, which will probably result in some level of stagflation, which is the worst case scenario, or we still have a higher than zero chance of reaching what the economics actually dictate should happen, which is essentially depreciation in the deflation in the currency, a shoring up of the currency as a result of restructuring that's happening on the back end and a lot of other people not taking risk and saving money. But the problem is right now, all the money's being saved by the bankers. It's all being saved by the billionaires. It's not being saved by the middle class. And this is different than at other points in time in U.S. history. At different points in time in U.S. history, it was the middle class that was the savings engine, right? Like in the 50s and 60s and 70s, you know, your grandparents, if you're my age, if you're in your 40s, your grandparents were the ones who were socking away money because they were Depression era babies and kids and people. And they lived through the rough times. And so they were putting money away. And at the same time, they were demanding a return on that cash. Well, nowadays you can get a return on the cash, but the people that have the cash aren't you, right? Which is why I think people are turning to desperate investments. They need NVIDIA to go from whatever it is now today, you know, $920 a share. They need it to go to $1,800 because they don't have any cash to sock away to make 4.5%, you know, risk-free and federally tax protected, right? They don't have a huge stockpile of cash. And they need Bitcoin to go to $1 million a coin because that's their only, what they think is their only lifeline, their only hope to building wealth long term because they don't have the cash. And so this is going to play out very poorly. It's actually a really scary prognosis. And I know I'm being a doomer here, but this is a scary prognosis because they're screwing with economics. And if you don't learn and see what they're doing, then you're going to end up as a statistical footnote. And it's not going to be a happy statistical footnote. It's going to be a very grave one. It's going to be a very dire one. And so I'm going to continue writing and continue live casting about ways around this, right? It's why being an anarchist investor right now is so important, because the areas where you can make money and put money to protect it or help it grow are the areas that at the very least are kind of leaning in to the economic cycle that we've just entered and that the central planners are trying to fight against. And in fighting against it, what they're essentially doing is they're screwing you over, right? And the way in which they're doing it is benefiting a select few people. And unfortunately, this kind of stuff also results in other really bad stuff. I mean, we're talking, you know, World War III type stuff, right? Like revolutions. I mean, you've already seen it throughout the world. You're seeing these countries have complete breakdowns and civil wars and revolution. That stuff is coming to the industrialized world, into the Western world, because of this dynamic. No one is going with the flow and allowing things to happen. They want the risk on to continue. And the problem is that that risk on means that, you know, you're moving up in stakes and you're moving down in the likelihood of success, right? And I wrote the example in my article earlier today. And a reminder, if you sub for free at anarchistinvestor.substack.com, April 1st, I'm giving away free silver. I wrote about it today. I think a lot of people have these investments, and it's akin to being at the poker table, and you think you have a royal flush, and you're pushing all of your money into the middle, right? The issue is that in poker, anyone who's familiar with poker, if you've played it for cash game or in tournaments or whatever, even your family games, okay, the vast majority of the time when you have a royal flush, you don't make any money, right? It's, you make money, I would make it akin to, like, you know, you have to set up your opponent, but you set them up with singles and doubles, right? You don't always hit home runs. And in fact, the vast majority of the times that you take that home run swing, it doesn't hit. Right, it's those the people that grind it out and make money playing poker aren't pushing all their chips in the middle with a royal flush and expecting to win. They expect that they're not going to get called, and the other person is going to essentially fold their cards because you have most of the good cards. Right, there's still some other good cards that could be out there, but you know, you're holding a fistful of them. It's less likely that they have better cards. But anyway, I digress. I think a lot of people think they have a royal flush, when truthfully, they have complete air. Or even if they are holding the greatest thing since sliced bread, and Bitcoin is the most miraculous thing ever to come into existence, it's still possible it doesn't succeed because of a lack of adoption, or because of World War III, or because of this, or because of that. There's all kinds of risks. And so there's other things out there that are, you know, safer bets, but they don't offer as big of a return. And unfortunately, if you don't have any cash, right, who's the most likely to play the lottery? It's poor people. Poor people play the lottery more frequently than wealthy people, because wealthy people understand the idea of risk return, and wealthy people don't want to, you know, give up $1, $2, or $5, or $100, because they can put it away and make more money over time. If you only have $5 in your pocket, it's difficult to understand how that $5 can turn into $100 outside of buying a lottery ticket or a scratch off or something like that. And the Federal Reserve has done this intentionally. I can't stress this enough, intentionally. And so every time Jerome Powell says, you know, when they talk about their mandate and part of their dual mandate being like full employment and that kind of thing, and then he talks about the undercurrent of, like, you know, equity and equality and stuff like that, I laugh every time. Like, I smirk, because it's a freaking lie. Like, and it's a bold-faced lie too. And it's under the cover of, you know, he has time on his hands. Like, who other than me as a degenerate sits there and looks back at what the Fed funds rate was in 2019 or in 2006 and 2007, right? There's not very many people who do that. If you have a day-to-day job that you go to, okay, you don't give a crap about that. You give a crap about what you have to do, take care of today, what your bills are, et cetera, et cetera. You're not worried about what the Fed funds rate was back in 2007, right? But I'm telling you that when you put these pieces, when you put the pieces of this puzzle together, it's a very scary puzzle. And unfortunately, the answers that a lot of people are being sold, I also think are just as risky, if not worse. Then, you know, it's like going from the frying pan into the fire. And so I have to offer you a word of caution, but I also have to tell you that there is places to go. There's places to make money and places to protect your money. And it has to do with some very basic risk management principles. And it has to do with just kind of keeping things in context and having perspective and understanding that there's a lot of people out there that are trying to sell you the cure for whatever. And they're full of crap, right? And you have to kind of take a measured approach. So I know I'm ending on like a really dark tone. I would remind you that when I'm live, I will take your comments. I'll take your questions. I want to hear what you're looking at, what you're questioning, what investments you're looking at. But so with that, there's one day left in the week. We're almost home. And I will be back here tomorrow at noon Eastern live. And again, a reminder, sub to Anarchist Investor. One of the places where you can make money for free is to get a free subscription to anarchistinvestor.substack.com. And you could win some silver. And silver is actual money as opposed to some of the other paper, toilet paper currency that's out there floating around. so with that, I'll give you a little smile to try and lighten the mood here at the end of this recording, at the end of this episode. And I want to tell you, I appreciate your time and I appreciate your attention and your energy. And I'm looking forward to continuing to do this for you and being the degen who looks back at what Fed funds rates were in 2006 and 2007 or back in 1977. All right. So I want to say thank you from the bottom of my heart. I appreciate all of you and I will see you tomorrow. Peace.